limits of the universe. And this, as I've often said, explains such truth as there may be in astrology. That when you want to draw a map of a person's soul, you draw a map of the universe as it was when he was born. We say that is your chart. That expresses you in a special way. Now, the astrologers' maps are very crude. They're based on a rather primitive view of the universe. But the truth of it is there, you see, that who you really are, your soul, your mind, is the total universe as focused upon you. And this connects with what in Mahayana Buddhism is called the doctrine of mutual interpenetration. Namely, that everything event in the world, anything, in other words, supposing the whole world is a moving pattern, and then you want to identify the wiggles in the pattern. It's very difficult to determine how much of a wiggle makes one wiggle. But by a sort of calculus in which we chew the thing up, we say all this wiggly world consists of so many wiggles, and each individual wiggle is a thing event. What is called in Japanese, ji, means a thing event. And so the idea of the doctrine of mutual interpenetration is that every thing event in the universe implies all the others. It goes with it. Doesn't matter how long it lasts or how short it lasts. The fact that it is or the fact that it was implies the existence of everything else. To put it in another way, the fact that there is a moth flying around me, it's very small, and it will soon run into a candle and extinguish itself. That little incident would not be possible at all except in the context of all these galaxies. Because their existence goes with the possibility of there being such a minute little life fluttering around. What is not so easy to see is the picture in the opposite direction. That in the same measure, all these galaxies depend upon and go with this little moth. As the poet Suso, Henry Suso, once said. No, it wasn't Suso. It was someone like him, lived about the same time. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, he said, I know that without me, God could not live for one moment. And this is the other aspect of it. And this is the difficult one to understand. And we shall be able to approach this in the course of the seminar. In fact, if you realize that, then you've really got it. You've got the point of your own existence. But to get the reverse picture, you have first of all to get clearly its opposite one, namely that the existence of any one minute little thing is intimately related to everything. And then what happens when you clearly understand that, and you've really got that, your mind does a flip, like that. You know, it's like when you squeeze the air into in a sausage balloon, and you get all the air squeezed up. You think into one end of the balloon and suddenly it goes bloop and it comes out the other end, you see? Well, it's sort of like that. And you have to be very careful at that point not to go crazy. But because you see, when you find out that all this universe depends on you, some people get frightened, others get cocky, and from both things, disasters can follow. You have to discover that and then be natural. Act as if nothing happened. So then this Buddhist idea, Mahayana Buddhist idea of mutual interpenetration is expressed by the great simile of the net of jewels, in which you have a multidimensional spider's web in the morning dew, and on inspecting one dewdrop you see the reflections of all the others, and in each reflection in turn the reflections of all the others, and again and again and again. And so of course one discovers this to be no mere philosophical fancy, no mere metaphor. When you start working with laser beams and finding out that you can reconstruct a whole photograph from a tiny snip out of the negative, because the crystalline structure of the whole photographic field, the chemical spread over the acetate or whatever, when it's exposed to light, all those crystals change in harmony with each other. See, supposing we all touch each other and then somebody says boo, we'll all jump a little bit together. And if you examine any one jump carefully enough, any one individual jumping, you will see, if you can find out enough about it, that the way he did it was in response to the ones next to him, and they did it in response to the ones next to them, and they jumped so far because they couldn't push any further, and some were a little bit pulled in their jump, and so on. And by seeing exactly what one of them did, you could reconstruct what all of them were doing. Only usually we don't bother to think about things like that, because it takes too long. And this is one of our great difficulties as human beings, that the mode of thinking upon which we largely rely for our practical calculations is unbelievably clumsy, because it can only deal with one thing at a time. And that doesn't get you anywhere. That's in a way why a great deal of scientific work is apt to be trivial. It's all very well if I had all that time to think it out. But I don't. I have to make practical decisions in a hurry. And I've no time. But on the other hand, here is nature. Here is your body. Not merely your body by itself as something bounded by the skin, but your body in relationship to a whole community of people and animals and bugs and vegetables, functioning in this astonishing way, doing myriads of things all together everywhere at once, and not thinking about it at all. It is astonishing, you know, how we overlook that. Because, of course, this is a faculty which everybody possesses. And therefore we say, well, that sort of cleverness is a dime a dozen. What we like to distinguish is special cleverness. People who can do strange tricks, like great feats of thinking and talking and intellectual and cerebral performance. But we mustn't forget that there are also people who do absolutely astonishing things without thinking at all. There are jugglers. There are very beautiful people. That's pretty astonishing when you pick out someone and saying, gee, isn't she gorgeous? And that's done without thinking. And it embarrasses many women to be told that they're beautiful, because they want to be admired for their intellectual achievements rather than for the bodies which their parents provided for them. And so we are a little bit on the defensive about the things that we achieve without our egos being in charge. But we do the most beautiful things that we do, really, by that means, because all that thought and intellectuality can do is it can embellish your natural talents. A lot of people who are incredibly good at thinking never do anything creative because they have no talent available. They may have it, but they don't know, they don't trust it, they don't know how to make use of it, and therefore their intellect works to little purpose. Because the in function of the intellect is to be the servant of the organic intelligence. You see? Only what we're doing is we're trying to make the intellect the master. The intellect is a wonderful servant, just so long as it knows its place. But once it becomes saying to nature, look, you submit. I know how you ought to be run. Now I'm going to take charge. That is the moment of hybris, where Adam eats the fruit of the tree of knowledge, that is to say, of technical knowledge, and tries to be God to the world. And God says, okay, baby, you try. Then you see you've got to work. That's why the curse of eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge was work. Everything became work. Cats, you know, dogs and birds, they don't do any work. It's true, they scurry around getting food, but that's what there is to do. That's fun. That's life. That's living. It's not work. Besides, you don't have to think about it. You have your brain tells you where to look for it. Your nose tells you where to find it. You do what comes naturally, and there it is. And if God so clothed the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, faithless ones? But I never met a minister. Never. Who would not comment upon that is a very impractical passage which we can't live up to. But to get back to space, all I was showing in this sort of digression was that our mind, our self, is not inside our heads, but extends. And so, you see, you have, as the great vehicle of this extension of the universe, you have space. And you see immediately that you cannot pin space down. You cannot really conceive space at all. Look at the wonder a child has when it asks questions and begins. What's up there? What's beyond? What's after that? What's after that? The child is absolutely fascinated by thinking about that. Do you know all children are fascinated with infinity? Don't you remember seeing, say, a child's book? And on the cover of this book is a little girl sitting, reading the same book with the same little girl on the cover. And so naturally, there's another little girl on the cover of the book she's looking at in the picture. And so the child begins to wonder, how small can it get? How far can it go? Or they get in opposing mirrors and look. And gee, that's wonderful. Why can't you line them up so that it doesn't just disappear around the corner always? Couldn't you get in straight on this? Seems so difficult. Mommy, what did God do before he started the world? You think back. What would it be like to be in heaven and live forever and ever and ever and ever? And immediately this somehow stretches the skull And children love doing this because children are always trying out experiments on themselves. You know, they prod themselves, pull themselves, they love to spin in circles and make themselves feel dizzy. Because that's a great thing, you know, that feeling, they're going like this, you see. They're always fascinated with the limits of experience. So what's out beyond that? Because now, when a sophisticated astronomer tries to tell you that space is finite, we're still, we resent this and say, all right, space is finite, but what's outside it? Well, the astronomer says, you see, you can only talk about an outside inside space. Outside space, there is no outside. You see, the mind won't take it. The sense, you see, of infinity. So, this space fascinates us, going on forever, expanding. It seems to be actually going on forever, you see? If the universe is a huge explosion. But you can see, can't you, I think this. Space, although you cannot pin it down, and it has the quality of infinity, there's no way of talking about space, because it has no color, it has no weight, you can't cut it, you can't possibly chop it into pieces. And yet, at the same time, you cannot differentiate it from solids. We come to another important point here, you see. That solid and space are in a secret conspiracy with each other. Actually, there's very little solid in the world. Most of what appears to be solid appears so by virtue of the speed at which it's jiggling. It's like an electric fan, which when put in rotation, the blades appear to form a solid disk. And this chair is solid for rather the same reasons. So you can't put your finger through it. It's moving too fast. But actually, whatever it is that's dancing in space is increasingly difficult to define. The more you think about energy, you see, and you can make a calculus of energy like you make a calculus of wiggles in the world, and you can say there are various waves or wavicles or particles of energy, which we give all sorts of different names to, but the more we pursue it, the more it all seems to disappear. Like space, the more you try to think what it is, the more difficult it is. So in the same way, the more you try to say, now come on, let's sit down, what is this here? It's all right if you stop at a certain point. Then you say, well, now we know, that's practical. Listen, let's not ask any more questions. And somebody says, never shut. See? But if you keep on asking questions, everything falls apart. You notice this in the scholarly world. Scholars spend far more time debunking than they do creating. Because everything that has ever happened has been debunked, practically. You can show that there is no evidence. You know that Julius Caesar existed, not really. Certainly there's no evidence that Jesus existed, that Socrates existed. There's a great deal of doubt about Plato. Probably the Emperor Ashoka was a myth, and so on. You know, you can go on in that indefinitely.